From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The coalition of oligarchs and right-wing ultranationalists that's held power in Kiev since the coup toppled the elected president Viktor Yanukovych last February may be falling apart. Several hundred protesters tried to break into the Ukrainian president's administration offices in the country's capital Tuesday, but were repelled by security forces guarding the building. The standoff grew into clashes in the streets. The demonstrators demanded access to the administration's conference room in order to make a TV statement. Their demands include the introduction of martial law in Ukraine and the resignation of the heads of all Ukrainian security agencies, from defense minister to prosecutor general, for incompetence. The Ukrainian capital has already seen several protests by volunteer troops who returned from Ukraine's war-torn Donetsk and Lugansk regions after the government disbanded the ultra-right IDAR battalion last week. On Sunday and Monday, IDAR fighters staged a protest and burnt tires outside the defense ministry. Journalist John White has written for newspapers and websites, including The Independent, Morning Star, Counterpunch, and Foreign Policy Journal. He's also a regular commentator on BBC Radio. He spoke with RT Tuesday.
There is a reaction to what is considered to be a lack of progress when it comes to the conflict in eastern Ukraine. I would suggest that the participation of the ultra-nationalist and neo-fascist elements, the right sector and Zlobida party people, may be prominent in this latest disturbance. But we have to trace it back to the toppling of the last legitimately elected Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych, in February 2014. If you recall, he was toppled as a result of mob rule. Mob rule supported by the West, encouraged by the West, funded by the West. This set a dangerous precedent. And this precedent, in conjunction with the fact the Ukrainian economy has tanked since it shrunk by 10% last year, has set the conditions for a social breakdown. The economy's collapsed. The people in Western Ukraine were promised benefits if they aligned with the West. If you recall, people like John McCain, Victor Nuland of the US State Department visited Maidan Square, handed out cakes and sweets, made speeches encouraging the protesters, presenting it as a flowering of democracy and the demand for democratic change. This was all nonsense. This was about Western expansionism. It was about isolating Russia. And what they did not take into account was the feelings of the people in Eastern Ukraine, who were not asked if they agreed with this alignment with the West. So Viktor Yanukovych, as I said, the last legitimately elected president of Ukraine, was toppled as a result of this unholy alliance between rightist forces, neo-fascist forces, and Western politicians and governments. And the benefits that they were promised as a consequence have not materialized. The economy has shrunk 10%. People are struggling. Unemployment is increasing. Inflation is on the rise. And so this is inevitably going to produce a backlash.
The late king of Saudi Arabia has been hailed as a champion against global hunger by the UN Secretary General. Ban Ki-moon spoke at a meeting at the UN Monday in memory of King Abdullah, who passed away 2 weeks ago. Representatives of regional groupings at the UN paid tribute to the king. Stephanie Kutrix reports.
The UN Secretary General said that King Abdullah was a wise and compassionate leader who guided Saudi Arabia's development. The king, he added, also worked to resolve peace and security challenges and address counterterrorism issues. And Mr. Ban said he was committed to reducing hunger across the world.
King Abdullah was a wise and compassionate leader who guided Saudi Arabia's development, worked to resolve peace and security challenges, and address counterterrorism, and devoted his energies to seeking reconciliation and understanding among people of different cultures through interfaith dialogue initiatives. I'm especially grateful for his stalwart support for the United Nations and the least fortunate among us. He was a champion against the global hunger. In 2008, during the crisis over high food prices, he arranged for the World Food Program to receive $500 million, the largest single donation that WFP has ever received. More recently, King Abdullah generously supported humanitarian assistance efforts in Syria and Iraq, where millions of people are in dire need. He also undertook important initiatives to promote dialogue among the world's faith. In 2008, he became the first king of Saudi Arabia to address the United Nations at an important two-day bridge-building gathering of world leaders. I met him on several occasions, most recently last July in Jeddah. At that time, we focused primarily on resolving the Middle East conflict and reviving the Arab Peace Initiative, for which he was the driving force. But our conversation also ranged more widely. He told me of his belief in fraternity and brotherhood among human beings. He stressed that tensions between cultures and faith are not a function of religion, but of politicians who exploit division. At the end of the meeting, I thanked him for his leadership. I told him I was energized by his compassion. He simply replied that he did not seek recognition or gratitude. Instead, he said, I quote, "What I do, I feel, is incumbent on any human being," end of quote. This message of humility and grace were his last words to me and the ones by which I will remember him most. King Abdullah lived through much turmoil and change. His efforts made an impact throughout the Arab and Islamic worlds and the international community.
Ban Ki-moon said he offered his condolences to the bereaved royal family and to the people of Saudi Arabia, adding that he looked forward to personally conveying his sympathy and support when he visits Saudi Arabia soon. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
Under King Abdullah's authoritarian regime, Saudi Arabia had one of the worst human rights records in the world, consistently ranking among the worst of the worst in Freedom House's annual survey of political and civil rights. Among the abuses by Abdullah's regime, as cited by major international human rights organizations, are torture and other ill-treatment of detainees, which was and is common, widespread, and generally committed with impunity, amputations of hands and feet for theft, and flogging for lesser crimes, such as sexual deviance and drunkenness, and public executions by beheading. Under Abdullah, the death penalty could be imposed for a wide range of offenses, including murder, rape, armed robbery, repeated drug use, apostasy, adultery, witchcraft, and sorcery, and it could be carried out by beheading with a sword, stoning, or firing squad, followed by crucifixion. Nevertheless, the U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Samantha Power, also showered praise upon the late Saudi monarch as she addressed the General Assembly Monday.
On behalf of the United States, as host country for the United Nations, I wish to offer our condolences to the people and government of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for the loss of King Abdullah bin Abdulaziz Al Saud. There is an Arabic proverb that says, "A tree begins with a seed." King Abdullah planted many seeds for Saudi Arabia's future. Perhaps none so much as in the education of his people. Shortly after ascending to the throne in 2005, he created an ambitious scholarship program to educate Saudi students abroad. Today, more than 87,000 Saudi students are currently studying in the United States, and 33,000 more students are studying in other countries around the globe. Nearly half of the Saudi students currently participating in the program in the United States are female. These scholarship students have not only been ambassadors for Saudi Arabia around the world, but upon returning home, they are ambassadors for the world in Saudi Arabia. The seeds planted in their students and their experience will grow in them and spread to their families and communities for the rest of their lives. Upon hearing of the King's passing, Mohammed Hakim, a Saudi PhD student in Canada, tweeted, "I am a scholar. I am the son of his dream. My heart is broken." King Abdullah also created both coeducational and all-female university and graduate degree programs at schools in the kingdom, and in 2011 granted women the right to vote and run in municipal elections. During King Abdullah's time on the throne, the United States and Saudi Arabia worked together to confront many challenges. King Abdullah prioritized strengthening the U.S.-Saudi counterterrorism relationship, including fighting violent extremist groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIL, and combating foreign fighters. King Abdullah was the author and proponent of the Arab Peace Initiative, a seminal document for building consensus behind achieving a viable, just two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In the words of President Obama, it is, quote, "an endeavor that will outlive him as an enduring contribution to the search for peace in the region," end quote. And King Abdullah's efforts to promote and expand interfaith dialogue will constitute a lasting legacy that we must all deepen. His humanitarian contributions, including the $500 million donation to address the humanitarian catastrophes in Iraq and Syria, are helping keep people fed this very cruel winter. As Secretary Kerry said last week, and we repeat today, the United States has lost a friend, and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the Middle East, and the world have lost a revered leader.
Meanwhile, the New York Times reported Tuesday that Saudi Arabia has been trying to pressure Russian President Vladimir Putin to abandon his support for President Bashar al-Assad of Syria, using the Saudis' dominance of the global oil markets at a time when the Russian government is reeling from the effects of plummeting oil prices. According to American and Saudi officials, Saudi Arabia and Russia have had numerous discussions over the past several months that have yet to produce a significant breakthrough. With a fifth of the world's oil reserves, Saudi Arabia is the leading player in OPEC and has thus far prevented the cartel from raising prices by cutting production despite dizzying price declines. Among the nations hit hardest by the recent price fall are Russia, Iran, and Venezuela. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro lashed out at the United States for expanding sanctions after the U.S. State Department Monday imposed visa restrictions on unnamed Venezuelan officials it accuses of human rights violations and corruption. Maduro described the new restrictions as an attack on Venezuela's sovereignty and hypocritical. The latest move by the U.S. came a day after the Venezuelan president accused Washington of plotting to overthrow the Caracas government. Maduro said that several Caribbean leaders had told him at last week's CELAC conference in Costa Rica that they had recently participated in a meeting with U.S. Vice President Joe Biden in Washington, where Biden allegedly spoke of plans for a coup against Caracas. Venezuelan officials have repeatedly stated that the opposition seeks to launch a coup in the country with the backing of Washington. The U.S. is widely believed to have orchestrated a coup against Maduro's predecessor, the late President Hugo Chavez, in April 2002. That coup was undone in less than 2 days by a popular uprising involving more than 1 million people on the streets of the capital. Meanwhile, Venezuelan authorities detained several executives of the country's top pharmacy chain over the weekend amid government accusations that retailers were hoarding basic supplies in order to create artificial shortages with long lines outside stores. The Venezuelan president said the retailer was employing the tactic in an attempt to sow discontent against the country's socialist government, pointing to similar moves employed by right-wing forces in the U.S.-backed coup in Chile in 1973. However, the efforts by some private retailers to create market chaos to topple the socialist government may have backfired as Caracas has taken steps to protect against further economic sabotage. Telesur's Cody Weddle reports from Caracas.
In a new effort to stop economic sabotage, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has announced the launch of a government mission called Operation Sucre. The effort will focus on taking control of stores and businesses that are engaging in speculation and economic sabotage in order to destabilize the country. Now, the new initiative has been named in honor of the independence hero Antonio José de Sucre. On Monday, President Maduro already announced the occupation of one such retail chain.
I have given specific orders to our security and food sovereignty vice president to occupy these chain stores in accordance with the laws of the Constitution. The owners of this company should be detained, and there should be an investigation owing to their involvement in illegal food hoarding.
Mexico's human rights record is under the spotlight as the country presents its long-awaited report on enforced disappearances to the UN. The dossier has been more than 2 years in the making, but the issue has sparked renewed international interest after 43 students were kidnapped in the state of Guerrero and reportedly killed last September. Daniel Johnson reports.
Mexican authorities say not enough has been done to track down the country's disappeared at the start of a UN human rights hearing on Monday.
Las personas desaparecidas son padres y madres.
There are real disappeared persons, mothers, daughters, husbands and wives who have life projects that have been destroyed.
Son proyectos de vida truncados.
Ms. Eliana Garcia from the Office of Mexico's Attorney General presenting her country's report to the UN Human Rights Watchdog and its Committee on Enforced Disappearances. The country faces renewed pressure to address the issue after six people died and 43 students disappeared from the municipality of Iguala last September, reportedly in operations involving police officers. Plans are underway to create a missing persons blueprint, Ms. Garcia said, though much more needs to be done before a reliable register is available for the whole country. Those comments were echoed by human rights expert Rainer Hula at the hearing in Geneva. He said there appeared to be no data on the number of disappeared people in Mexico. Daniel Johnson, United Nations.
The concerns about the accuracy of the data offered by the Mexican government were illustrated by comments offered Monday to the UN Committee on Forced Disappearances by the parents of some of the missing student teachers who were at the session in Geneva to present their own cases. Hilda Legedeño, the mother of Jorge Tizapa Legedeño, one of the missing 43 student teachers, said that, in her opinion, they are alive and the government has them hidden away, pointing to inconsistencies in the investigations. Legedeño said it is incomprehensible that until now there have been no criminal proceedings brought against the ex-governor of the state of Guerrero, Aniel Aguirre, or Jorge Luis Abarca, the ex-mayor of Iguala, currently in custody. In her opinion, she said, even President Enrique Peña Nieto should be tried for his failure to act in violation of the duties of his office. Another parent of the missing, Bernabe Abrahan, the father of student Adán Abrahan de la Cruz, said the objective of going to Geneva was both to ask for help from the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights to find their children and to demand justice. Further proceedings in the case took place Tuesday. Comments by Oprah Winfrey that appeared to denigrate the actions of activists in Ferguson, Missouri, prompted a response by some of those who have organized there. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford has more.
Oprah Winfrey recently used her billion-dollar media podium to belittle the leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement. Winfrey claimed that the young activists don't know how to organize and don't know what they want. In Ferguson, Missouri, we spoke with Torian Russell, one of the leaders of Hands Up United, who's been a key organizer since the day Michael Brown was killed by a cop. Russell has some choice words for Oprah. But first, we asked him how the Ferguson community has responded to word that the Justice Department has no plans to indict former officer Darren Wilson.
We really don't care if the system brings up charges or indicts them. The community has indicted him. That's why he's no longer working in Ferguson. And it's really sad because, you know, a lot of community thought when the Department of Justice stepped in, it was like Superman coming to save the day. But, you know, you find out when you get older, when you wake up, you know, Superman is a fictional character, and you have to actually go out there and save yourself.
Yes, at the very least, the movement has succeeded in smoking out the Justice Department and making them admit that they're not going to do anything.
I think that's the point of, you know, people say they don't like marching and protest. But it woke up a lot of people to the hypocrisy that is the system. You know, it's no checks and balances for the system upon itself. But if you commit a crime or if you do anything, it's instant justice. Just last night, the president of the police union here in St. Louis assaulted a woman on local TV in a public safety hearing, and he was escorted out by the police. So as long as the system is abusing you here, you know, locally in St. Louis or nationally or abroad, because some of our people just left Palestine and saw the treatment of how they treat Afro-Palestinians over there, they have a monopoly on the violence. We're trying to change the minds on people. What does the system actually do for you?
What kind of changes have you seen in Ferguson in terms of who has been willing to become active and committed and who has not?
The same people who were probably not on our side before, you know, some of the elected officials, some of the elders, some of the major organizations that get some major funding, and the funding never trickles down to the community. Those people are still on the outside. So the activists and the organizers like myself, we've been able to go into the communities and that basically continue the work of what I would call Dr. King. And the reason they killed Dr. King was poor people's campaign. You know, talking to some of these single mothers, some of these convicted felons, some of these gang members, drug dealers, every common day folk, and galvanize them towards political education. Some people are willing to run for office. Some people are willing to do programs. But I think just the way that we interact and how we love and support our community is changing here in Ferguson and in St. Louis.
Well, would you say that Ferguson and Greater St. Louis are more organized communities because of the activities of the last several months?
So, yeah, of course. You know, it's like the Ella Baker theory. You know, everybody, we're not accustomed to large orgs because what they've done is, you know, not live up to their mission statement. So we have a lot of organizations working together in coalition and also doing work in the community. I think that the strategy going forward and this kind of things that other groups out here, as well as us, the Hands Up United, has been a community building process. We protest, we do actions of civil disobedience, but I want everyday life to be a protest. I want where you buy your clothes from is a protest. You know, what grocery store you go to, that can be a protest. What books you read. I want everyday life in my community to be a protest for the people.
What kind of political education have you undergone in this struggle?
I'm constantly reading. I actually got Ready for the Revolution with me here right now. I also got the compensatory textbook on racism and white supremacy by Neely Foley Jr. That's kind of like the, you know, the Bible for me around racism and tactics. But going to the Department of Justice here and showing the people that that's a farce and a facade. Well, we did the Reclaim MLK. We educated some people on the real legacy of Martin Luther King, not the whitewashed one, not just I Have a Dream speech, but, you know, the speech at Riverside, and educated people on the Poor People's Bill of Rights. We're doing a lot of educational pieces so people can know what they're fighting for long term. Chancellor Mike Brown is very symbolic around education because Mike Brown was one of the most poorest performing educational schools in the state of Missouri, lived in a community that had high unemployment, less opportunities, and a lot of people are going to jail out of these communities. So it's a political education piece every time we take to the streets.
I'm sure you've heard Oprah Winfrey's remarks about the leadership of this new up-and-coming movement. She doesn't seem to think much of it. Her remarks indicate that she believes it is not producing a leadership and folks are not making demands and they're not saying what they want.
It's easy when you got millions of distractions. You know, I don't know if she missed Ferguson in October, or the protests in August, or 40,000 people who marched for Eric Garner in New York, or the 200 cities that held protests around the country around the 9 indictment. I don't know if she missed that. I don't know if she doesn't watch CNN. I don't know if she understands who's been to the White House, who's been to the UN on the behalf of black genocide and black torture in America and abroad. You know, it's easy to criticize the starting quarterback from the sideline. I would ask Oprah, you know, maybe if she came here early, she would have found out who these people are and what we're doing. You know, it's not my job to go out, put a billboard out and go to the white media who's slanted and biased, who will lift you up just to lift you up on a pedestal high enough to get you killed like Dr. King or Malcolm X or, you know, or young people. We have young leaders out here, but I don't want them to be young faces that become Fred Hampton either. So, you know, maybe she came here, met the people, and I'm going to be honest, bring your checkbook with you, because we can't get free if we can't do anything for the people in the community. So, you know, maybe she would come here. You know, that's my thing. I'm not going to ostracize her. She just doesn't know. My job is like most people. I'm just here to teach you so you have a better understanding, and then we can go from there.
Maybe she's saying that you don't express what you want because she really doesn't like what you're expressing.
I mean, that's the thing. You know, a person in my org, a fellow activist, T-Dub-O, who went to the White House, he said, we didn't beg to be at your job and have a position and have a nice, shiny title for too long. We've been disenfranchised. How about you allow us to have our own building and we can actually compete for this American dream, but it's not merit-based. So if my black skin's being seen, then I don't have a fair shake at it. So, you know, maybe what we want is not what she wants. Maybe that's it. But freedom and liberation is self-determined. So, it's not for her. It's not for the collective to tell people what it is. People decide for themselves or for the group, and collective freedom can come about that. So, you know, maybe, I don't know. I don't know how plugged in she is. Until I meet her or until she expounds on her statements, I'm assuming that, you know, she has a billion distractions, literally. So she has a billion distractions. Maybe she unplugged long enough to come to Ferguson, come to St. Louis. She'll see the progress. She'll see that we want educational reform and judicial reform. We want local control of our policing. We want systemic jobs, private and public. We have a list of demands around just killings. Since August 18th, I believe they've been published on the internet and also in magazines and articles. So maybe she would, you know, unplug from a billion reasons and find the one reason, which is the freedom and liberation for oppressed people here and abroad. She'll know what the long-term strategies are.
That was Dorian Russell of Hands Up United in Ferguson, Missouri, speaking with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford. February is Black History Month. We bring you this commentary from Mumia Abu Jamal.
In celebration of African Heritage Month, for Profiles in Excellence, we honor Billie Holiday was a consummate jazz singer whose work continues to inspire and influence even after the passing of 50 years. What made her a legendary musical figure wasn't the power of her voice, nor its versatility. There were many women who far exceeded her on that score. What made her distinctive was both the honest, vulnerable tone of her sound, as well as the power of her material. Her classic, Strange Fruit, became an anthem against racist lynchings and discrimination. She played with melody, experimented with sound, and counted among her fans Malcolm X, who saw her live. Born Eleonora Fagan in Philadelphia, according to historian Charles Bloxon, she took the name Holiday from her father, Clarence. Despite her enormous talent, her life was marked by tragedy. She suffered from abuse and from heroin use. But as she might croon, "Ain't nobody's business if I do." This is Mumia Abu Jamal.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit. Blood on and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar tree.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.